Early Ukraine's Prime Minister accused Moscow of wanting to start World War III.
1972, I was sitting at my desk at about 4:30 in the morning at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet. What I discovered, ladies and gentlemen, is that there has been a plan in existence since about 1917 to create an artificial extraterrestrial threat to this Earth in order to create a one-world totalitarian government.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist and me, Tony Gosling. And his name, of course, is Martin Summers, that Old Labour Oxford economist. A wave of firebombs attacks over the last year is claimed by anarchist groups, but is this just the excuse the police needed to put Bristol's anti-fascists under surveillance? Tomorrow is the Anarchist Book Fair at the Trinity Centre near Trinity Road Police Station on Trinity Road itself. And we speak to Phil from the Anarchists all about the book fair. Also, the Kiev government in Ukraine has sent the army in to break up checkpoints in between Donetsk and Kharkov, killing five protesters. But what would we do here in Britain if the far right took over the British police? And do the Kiev government really want peaceful elections next month? Also, the CIA's most expensive operation since the billions spent in the 1970s, election fixing over in Italy. That is Operation Cyclone. In Afghanistan in the 1980s, we hear all about it from the CIA's most senior whistleblower ever. That is John Stockwell, who ran the CIA operations to destabilise Angola. We start this week with Phil. Welcome to Drive Time, Phil. And you've got your Anarchist Book Fair, the annual event, tomorrow. Tell us, what is it that makes you, or draws you, away from the political party we've been hearing about in the first hour and towards anarchism? Why?
Well, Teddy, a lot of us feel that the political process doesn't really work for ordinary people, and tomorrow's event is about ideas and about action, about changing your community, and about changing our futures.
But how? Why anarchism? I mean, you know, what? Tell us, what does an anarchist believe, if anything?
Well, I think the main principles are freedom and equality. How exactly you apply that to everyday life is why we have events like tomorrow, so that we can discuss how we get those principles put into action.
So, don't you wonder sometimes whether if the anarchists were to stand in an election with, say, for example, a none-of-the-above candidate, whether actually you might actually get to power, actually start to control some of the purse strings for cities like Bristol?
Well, that has been tried in the past by people in Bristol, I think, a few years ago, a bit before my time. But it's not about taking power, it's about giving ordinary people power. So the whole system we have at the moment, where you win an election and then you're in charge for 5 years, isn't really what we're about. We're about giving people control about their day, about their life every single day at work and in the community.
But the trouble is, the way we are at the moment, I mean, people are getting less and less power. As, for example, the basic standards, basic minimum standards we've got in Britain, provided by the welfare state since just after the Second World War, slowly being taken away, Phil, we're getting less of it, not more.
Yeah, that's a massive problem. I think that there's two things we can do about that. One is defending what we've got and stopping it being taken away. And the other is to try and build new forms of community and new organisations to replace what we're losing. So we're doing that through new unions, new community organisations. There's a community union just started in Easton, which is launching in a few weeks, called Acorn. Those are really interesting developments. And
what is a community union?
That's where residents get together and organise to make their collective voice heard, whether that's through the council, with the police, with planning applications, or whether it's to do the low wages, bad housing. once people are organised together, they get listened to. You can ignore one person, but you can't ignore 100 people.
Surely what people should be doing is, say, lobbying their local councillors. If those local councillors are good, they can actually make a difference in the corridors of power up at City Hall. And I know there's another name for City Hall that the Bristolian paper calls it, but maybe we shouldn't be mentioning that now. But actually, surely you can work through the state, and you should be working through the state, do you?
I think when people get involved in politics, then I think they should try working with their councillor, they should try working with their MP, because I think that's a learning process. You will see how far you get going down those avenues. And I'm not here to tell people I'm right, do it my way. Go and try that. Try lobbying your local councillor. I think you might have some success, but you'll get very frustrated. And that's when people realise that they need to organise collectively, because the country is in the state at the moment because of the system we have of MPs and city councils. It's failing. By all means, try, but I think we need something else as well.
Okay. What is you as an anarchist? What is your vision for cities like Bristol? Let's just leave the national scene aside for a while. But how would you like to see the city organised?
Well, my personal vision, I don't want to push on everyone, but I would... do you mean politically or economically?
I suppose both. What difference would you like to see in the way we... At the moment, what we do is we vote for councillors, mm-hmm. and they have certain powers over where money is spent, but mostly that's what they're doing, is they are controlling how that collective purse is spent. Mm-hmm. The council tax and various other taxes that come, those councillors we elect, plus, of course, Lord Ferguson, sort of hovering above them all, make these big decisions about how that money's spent. How would you like to see that done differently?
Well, I don't think having a mayor was a positive step. The council, for all its faults, I think personally was a better system, very far from perfect. It's really sad that so few people vote in local elections, which shows the council's not really representative. I think it's really important to give more local groups a voice, like resident associations, community unions, and in the really long term, we'd like to see a lot more cooperative businesses, for them to be organised and to have a voice, a lot more trade union involvement and consultation with unions on what happens in the city.
But, say, for example, by some magic process, you became the next mayor of the city. How would you reorganise it to make it actually fulfil what you think people's needs better than it is at the moment?
Well, I can't see myself as mayor, but... if I did find myself in that position, the first thing I would do is stop implementing the government's policy of cuts and austerity. I can't understand why a man would enter politics to do that. George Ferguson says he doesn't agree with the cuts, and yet he says they're inevitable and he's going to implement them. Nothing is inevitable, so... he should stand up and stop doing the Conservatives' work.
But it's certainly, I'd agree with you, it's very noticeable the way he's basically saying, oh yes, we've got to go along with this. He's not, when we were told, if you vote for a mayor, we were also told, well, that mayor will have the ear of Cameron, he will have the ear at Downing Street, people will listen to him. And yet he's saying, oh yes, we've got to go along with all this. Tell us a bit about the book fair for people that have never been before. What sort of things are there? Obviously it's not just books for sale. What's it all about?
It's our sixth year now. So it's a lot of people selling books, but also a lot of local campaigns about rights at work, about the environment, about communities. Lots of meetings about different political issues at the moment, and about history. We're working in conjunction with Bristol Radical History Group, who will be at Hydra Books down Old Market. We've also got a cafe there. We've got a kids and families space. I don't think the weather's going to be that great for the garden, but there's the lovely permaculture garden at Trinity. So it's Yeah, it's a day full of ideas and a really good place to meet people.
Now, I know, I mean, I was down there last year, and when George Ferguson turned up, didn't he, in his little car, and he got a cup of hot coffee thrown over him, and I wonder, is that the sort of thing that you can expect at an anarchist event? Because, this, you know, it does seem a little bit unfair, that kind of thing, but people may think that that's legitimate.
Well, the mayor got talking to one of his constituents, and they had quite a disagreement about the cuts. It wasn't actually an anarchist who threw the coffee on him, it was a socialist visitor of ours. But yeah, it's mostly very good-natured, and a beverage thrown over someone was the most disagreeable thing that happened.
Had a very good lunch there, I did last year, very good. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Can we take anarchists and anarchism seriously when they're not actually that engaged with the current political process, that is to say through elections and that kind of thing?
Well, I think they can be taken seriously, and certainly in Bristol, where there's a very strong anarchist movement, probably one of the strongest in the country. I think when we talk, you focused all there on the city council. Just think of all the other things that go on in Bristol, all the businesses that run here, all the hospitals and all the rest of it. You can't vote for people to run those, can you? There's no, you know, squabbling over who runs the city council is the real power in society is experienced every day.
Well, actually,
by your boss at work. I mean, by the fact that you can't get a bus because the bus has been cut.
If you're a member of the hospital trust, for example, you can vote for somebody to be or not to be on the whole hospital trust board. You know, so
there are ways of engaging. I am engaged in mainstream politics. I'm an activist with the Labour Party, but I understand what the strength of anarchism is, the idea that you don't wait for somebody to do it for you, you organise to do it for yourself if you can. I have doubts whether you can actually organise everything in that way, but I think there's nothing wrong with people trying to do things for themselves, and because, of course, the state is only a tiny part of what goes on. In Bristol, people experience authority every day in their workplaces and in their communities, and that authority sometimes comes from the state and sometimes comes from the private sector, comes from criminal gangs, comes from the police. What's useful about anarchism is it problematises the idea of authority. It doesn't just presume that somebody has to be in charge. So if somebody's going to be in charge, the case has got to be made for somebody to be in charge. It's not just, we can't just presume that there's always got to be somebody in charge. Why presume that?
Phil, I mean, you go back to, say, the mid-1800s when the very first police arrived on the scene. This country ran for centuries with no police, actually. And there is this problematic relationship between anarchists and the police. The trouble is, I mean, at least, you know, a lot of anarchists will challenge the legitimacy of the police, for example. But at the end of the day, if something happens, if a crime's committed against you, you, like everyone else, will surely have to phone the police in order to get things sorted out.
Well, the problem with the police is that it's so unaccountable. It's officially accountable through the police commissioner and the IPCC. But we really have to question whether... I mean, the Independent Police Complaints Commission, we really have to question whether it is independent. I mean, the number of things they've investigated and whitewashed...
Well, we've just had the figures this week. Yeah. 4 deaths in custody every week for the last year. Still no police actually having to take being prosecuted for those, or at least no successful prosecutions. We had the example in one of the courts, I think it was here in Bristol, just yesterday, of a police officer tasering a naked person in a cell. And you know there are certain questions about that, but there are some checks and balances. So again, I'm going to put it to you, if you could organise the police better, how would you like to organise them?
Well, for a start, I'd look at how they do it in other countries, where they separate the police that stop crime on the street to the police who investigate crimes. I mean, if there's a murder, obviously you need someone to investigate it, but that person doesn't have to have the right to slap handcuffs on someone for no good reason. You have, in other countries, they have professional investigators who investigate crimes. They don't wander around with body armour and truncheons and CS spray on them. And also, we need to have a democratic judiciary. We have to have the police accountable to the communities they police. We don't have any of this in this country. We have a centralised police force that can it goes round armed and can do what it wants.
Well, it's not centralised, is it? Because it's divided up into something like 40 different forces, and that's... I mean, there have been attempts to bring it all together into one super force.
Sure. I mean, it's not nationally unified, but when I talk about decentralised, I mean about the people in Eastern, the police in Eastern being accountable to people of Eastern, like that locally, not Avon and Somerset Constabulary covering millions of people.
Well,
locally accountable.
We've also heard that one of the things that the police are planning to do is to create these like super custody suites around the county, Bristol and Somerset. Three giant custody suites, one out at Filton, others down, I think, down in Somerset, one at Weston, possibly, and down in that direction. So, you know, well, they, like everybody else, Phil, are suffering with cuts, and they're saying, well, look, if we're going to organise this, we're going to have to do it more cheaply. So, I mean, you know, they have their problems too.
Absolutely. And while I'm not a fan of the police, I think it is a good thing that they're starting to wake up to the government's attitude to all public sector workers, and maybe some people in the police will start to open their eyes to what's going on in this country and the interests that they're protecting.
Martin, what about that? Because the police are sometimes seen, obviously, by a lot of anarchists as just basically enforcing what is essentially a wicked system. I mean, we've seen a lot of cruelty from this government when it talking about... I mean, there was a lady who spent her life up in Kingswood as a nurse, and she was there just told, well, you're not going to get any benefits, and she committed suicide. There are all sorts of other people who are suffering destitution, food banks and things, even though we are the sixth richest country in the world.
Well, we're talking about the failures of capitalism here, and capitalism is in terminal failure mode. And this is why radical ideas of all kinds are going to be coming to the fore, because it's quite clear that the current setup is no longer sustainable.
But they said that before the Second World War, didn't they, in the Great Depression? That this was, you know, that capitalism was never going to recover. Some people said
it took a world war and 50 million dead, so let's not don't be blasé about that. In the 1930s, the anarchist movement in Spain was a major player in the civil war in Spain, and I think in that era that they'd been building their social movement from the late 1890s, so they'd had 40-50 years to build their movement. And of course the Spanish state didn't do anything much for the ordinary people. The only thing the state did was to send the police around to beat you up and throw you in prison for being on strike. So there was not really, and people really had to organise their own stuff, because the state, there was no benefits. The state had no kind of redeeming features. It wasn't there to help people. It was obviously not. And in the areas controlled by the anarchists during the Civil War, they started to try and organise things in their own way. But of course, it's in the middle of a war, and it's rather tricky. And of course, the other problem is if you're fighting a war, you've actually got to organise yourself to fight the war, which of course was a big conundrum for the anarchists.
Phil, are you aware of more people looking to anarchism at the moment? Because, I mean, certainly you would imagine they would, because a lot of the political parties now seem to be hemorrhaging support. I mean, for example, we're now in a situation where there are actually 15 times more members of trade unions than political parties. Many people who have been members of the major political parties for decades have just decided, well, there's no point in this, because there's no difference between what these major political parties are saying.
Yeah, we're seeing every year we've done this, the event's got bigger. I think people are looking for new ideas. The old politics has really failed, and Labour's not really offering anything different to the Conservatives. They're arguing over about 5% of the cuts. Labour's not going to be radically different.
Martin, I mean, how would you face that sort of question on the doorstep? Everyone is saying similar things, aren't they? Well, that Labour, for example, invented this whole crazy PFI thing where people have to pay double if they want a hospital, and private businesses take a massive cut, for example, and also certainly the beginnings of the privatisation of the National Health Service and the Post Office, for example, were brought in by Labour, weren't they?
Well, they were indeed, and the reason I stay in the Labour Party is to fight exactly those kind of policies, which I find... and of course, there's a limit to how far you can do that, because the democracy in the party has been stripped away. I think we need to build mass social movements for a better society, a post-capitalist society, because capitalism really is on its last legs. And I'm not representative of mainstream Labour Party opinion, for sure. But I think what will happen is if people start asking and demanding reasonable treatment and then they don't get it, then we can start talking more radically about what may be required to get that reasonable treatment put in place. But don't forget, all of us with radical ideas, anarchists, socialists like myself, we've got to recognise that we don't have majority support yet, because people are still brainwashed by capitalist propaganda. They still believe that the recovery is going to take place, and that if they keep their heads down, eventually they'll be all right. I don't think that's true, and eventually people are going to realise.
Phil, do you think capitalism's on its last legs?
I'm not too sure about that. I think what is on its last legs is the welfare state and the sort of post-World War II settlement. We're increasingly seeing profitable work concentrated in the hands of a few, like a sort of polarisation of society, where we do still have some manufacturing, well-paid jobs, but most people in very low-paid and precarious employment. And I don't think that can continue for very long before people will start to really question where we're going. And there's all the environmental problems as well. That's the other big car crash waiting to happen, I'm afraid.
It is another one, absolutely right. And what about accusations? And I hear this quite a bit, that actually the far left, which you could probably consider, I don't know if you would accept that the anarchists are far left, but a lot of people do, and you can maybe answer that one as well. But the far left is actually rather like the far right, that they actually almost meet together around the back somewhere.
Well, that's something liberals love to say, to discredit everyone in one go. But no, it's really, really not the case. We're not close to the Stalinist left, which saw the state as being in charge. We want local communities to be in charge, and if we need national governments, it to be through federation and cities like Bristol choosing to cooperate with other cities and to build larger forms of government in that way, in a consensual way,
because we're beginning to see something a little bit like this. I mean, in Catalonia they're talking about seceding from Spain. The Venetians have just had a vote where they've said they would like to secede from Rome. I mean, as capitalism, as Martin's saying, starts to break down, the people with the wealth start to control what happens to that collective purse. I mean, do you think that might... I mean, we've also heard, I think it was yesterday, something about Cornwall being granted minority status, and lots of other parts of Britain also saying the same. Actually, if Cornwall's going to have minority status, we want minority status. So what are your thoughts about this whole thing of secession? I mean, not least to mention the east of Ukraine and Crimea. The people there have said we don't want anything to do with this new government in Kiev.
Yeah, well, the nation state is quite a recent invention in the sort of grand scheme of things. It's only been last 200 years. It's sort of become a worldwide phenomenon. I don't think secession's a bad thing, as long as it actually has some content and it does give people more power and control over their lives. If it is just sort of a fragmenting of different national groups based on jingoism and hatred, that's really not positive, which is what we see in Ukraine is kind of worrying. But if people are actually getting properly devolved powers to do what they want where they live, then that's a good thing. If it's just replacing one set of politicians with another set, then it doesn't really mean anything.
Okay, we had quite a discussion about immigration before. Do you see UK Independence Party as a racist party? And what are your thoughts about immigration? Because there are a lot of people who are saying, well, actually, if we have unbridled immigration, it's just wearing away the pay and conditions people have fought for in Britain for centuries.
Well, I don't really see it as working like that. Most people who come here as immigrants come here to work. They get jobs, they pay taxes, that creates a bigger economy, creates more jobs. There's no reason why immigration has to cause unemployment. The one thing that might is if immigrants are getting exploited and not being paid the minimum wage, so if they're not joining unions and getting exploited on low wages. If people just come here and work hard, then I think that's a positive thing. I think UKIP are racist. They always say foreigners and instead of putting it in racial terms. But basically they're saying people who weren't born here don't deserve to be here, which I think at the end of the day is racist.
Okay, just remind us again where and when the book fair is taking place and what we can expect to find.
Okay, so it's tomorrow, it's starting at 11 o'clock, going on until 6. We'll have food there all day. It's free entry, so yeah, just drop down, have a look around. There's loads of people who will have a conversation with you.
Okay, just to remind us also whereabouts the Trinity Centre is for people that don't know it.
Oh, everyone knows where Trinity is, surely.
No, well, not if they're on the outside, outskirts of town or whatever.
So it's on Trinity Road, postcode is BS20NW. It's right next to the police station, very conveniently for us.
Okay, and the timings?
11 till 6, and then there's an after party at the Red Lion Pub on Whitehall Road.
Okay, Phil, wish you the very best with it tomorrow. Good luck.
Thanks and, for having me, Tony.
Yes, thanks for coming in.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
There is also this slight problem, it seems, with some people who are at least calling themselves anarchists, Martin. The informal anarchist group, Channel 4, reported recently more firebombings going on here in Bristol. What are your thoughts about that? Because certainly it seems to me that there may be an attempt to maybe blame, you know, anarchists and use it as an excuse to infiltrate groups.
Well, it does worry me. In Piazza Fontana in 1969 in Milan, there was a bomb in the Banca Agricola which killed 9 people. The anarchists were immediately blamed by the local, and there's quite a strong anarchist movement in Italy similar to the one in Spain that we mentioned earlier, and the anarchists were all rounded up by the police in Milan, given a ferocious hiding in the police headquarters, and one of them was thrown out of the top window in the police headquarters, Giuseppe Pinelli, and this became the basis of Dario Fo's play Accidental Death of an Anarchist. Subsequently, it became clear through parliamentary investigations that the bomb had been planted by NATO intelligence services in order to frame the anarchists. And not only had the anarchists not done it, the state had actually planted the original bomb which killed 9 innocent people. Now, this so-called informal anarchist group, which has claimed 3 attacks in the Bristol area, one on the firearms training place, which was burned down, one an attack on the railway, which was thwarted by railway workers who saw what was some kind of obstruction being placed on the railway, and the third attack has been on a military vehicle, I believe, at the Territorial Army.
Well, 3 military vehicles, actually, at the Royal Marines, claimed by an anarchist group. This is Channel 4 News saying this. Avon and Somerset Police confirmed in February to Channel 4 News that 3 vehicles were set alight at the Royal Marine Reserve Base at Clifton in Bristol. Around 3:40 a.m, someone had gone to the Royal Marines Force Voluntary Reserve Base in Litfield Place, Clifton Down, set fire to 3 vehicles. That was the most recent one, apparently.
Yeah, but all, as I understand, claimed, or at least somebody claimed, as the informal anarchist group. Now, the informal anarchist group have carried out another attack in Milan about 5 years ago. They kneecapped a nuclear engineer. Now, I'm very worried about this kind of stuff because it fits the pattern of what we saw during the strategy of tension in Italy, whereby outrages and actions take place. I mean, kneecapping somebody is probably more serious than burning vehicles, although attempting to derail a train is pretty silly. But the point is that NATO intelligence services have in the past tried to create enemies, not just Islamist militants, not just provisional Republicans, but also to create enemies of anarchists. And this is part of a strategy to militarise the state. Now, I don't know what happened in these cases, but I find it extremely suspicious that this term informal anarchist group has been used three times in Bristol and once in Milan, which is where the whole strategy of tension began in 1969 in the Banca Agricola, where the anarchists were blamed and Giuseppe Pinelli died under police torture. We don't know what's going on here, but I don't like it.
Okay, also it's worth saying that as part of Operation Gladio, there were quite a lot of attacks on police stations, on police as individuals, which was also run out of NATO intelligence.
What the NATO intelligence services were doing, and this has all been covered in Posimato's book, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. They were basically carrying out attacks through cutouts. So there were quite a lot of left groups, some anarchists, some not anarchists, which were engaged in what you might call armed actions. But many of these groups have been infiltrated and were being used by the state in order to bring forward a militarisation agenda. And at the same time, of course, they were encouraging fascists to carry out outrages, including the bombing of Bologna railway station, which killed 80-some-odd people in 1980. Again, the finger pointed straight back at NATO intelligence services. There's been a parliamentary inquiry in Italy and in Belgium and in Switzerland, which have all concluded the same. There's a very good book about it by Daniel Ganzo, who's a Swiss academic, NATO's Secret Armies. There's the Frankovich film on BBC Two, which came out in 1993, which covered this whole era. Now, we've got to be very, very cautious at this situation, because NATO intelligence services have a track record of carrying out provocational terrorism as a means of trying to basically militarise society. Now, it may be that some misguided people who believe themselves to be anarchists have been involved in these actions. The Red Brigades carried out the assassination and kidnap and assassination of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy. But that, too, turned out to be orchestrated by NATO intelligence services. So the only people that don't do... The similar things used to happen in Ireland, where bombs would go off and the IRA would be blamed. The first bomb that went off in Ireland in 1969, where it blew up an electricity substation and was blamed on the IRA, was actually carried out by the Ulster Volunteer Force, probably with assistance from army and police. So this is the danger, is that anarchism is going to be demonised as a result of the actions that have been taken. And I don't want to see that happen, because I don't believe that most anarchists do support such actions. And in any case, more to the point, this smells to me of NATO disinformation and destabilisation.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the CIA's most expensive operation since the billions spent in the 1970s, election fixing in Italy. It's Operation Cyclone, and it took place in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So we hear about it all now from the CIA's most senior whistleblower ever. His name was John Stockwell. He ran CIA operations over in Angola. But here he is talking on the programme Alternative View in the 1990s, all about Operation Cyclone. And we'll hear from Martin about that same operation after we've heard this.
The Afghani operation is the biggest one in the history of the CIA, and they managed to divert, biggest in every sense, including the fact the largest heroin smuggling ring left behind. And they managed to keep it from, not secret, but keep it from being a focal point of debate for the six major years that it was run.
How could it have been bigger than Vietnam?
Vietnam became the Vietnam War with U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force, billions of dollars. Laos had always been cited as the CIA's biggest war. Vietnam became an overt war. Laos remained a CIA secret war. And the hundreds of millions of dollars there, supported with Air Force bombing and everything. But Afghanistan is... they haven't published the figure. I've never been able to find anyone who confident, like the archives, National Security Archives, Scott Armstrong in Washington, a solid figure on how much they've spent in Afghanistan, but it's in the billions. John, let's biggest in the history. I'm going to hedge a little bit because this is not an area of my primary expertise, and I have not been able to travel there and look at it like I did Nicaragua and El Salvador and Angola and all of that. But you essentially have it. We do have it. The Admiral Turner, when I debated him at Colby College, he was boasting about that covert action, that he had started it, mm-hmm. and citing it as an example of a successful covert operation. They set it in motion, and then eventually it led to the Soviets having to withdraw their troops. The game that they're playing, essentially the U.S., the parallel to Vietnam is significant. We invaded, they invaded, each created governments that invited us in, so to speak. What we've been doing in Afghanistan is just pure and simple shotgun destabilization, funding anybody that's got a group, giving them arms through Pakistan. We have not created a force, our government, our movement, or anything that believes in anything to step into the vacuum. I debated, I thought I was going to debate an Afghani professor at the World Affairs Conference in Boulder last year, and who, because he was paid working for the VOA and U.S. propaganda arm, so I presumed he was bought and paid for. And he kept telling me, you know, just let me finish my sentence, so to speak. And I did, and what he said is what the powers have done is condemned Afghanistan to eternal violence and conflict.
Yes, it looks like it's going to be horrible.
They're pulling out, and this side is not going to agree to relent, and the Soviets are going to see what they would call a necessity to keep arming the other side. This is where you get into a test, if you will, of Gorbachev's sincerity and Bush's, you know, kinder, gentler, you know, goodness in the nation. Do they really mean it? They're trying to convince the world that the Cold War is winding down. Doonesbury's already told us the Cold War is over. It isn't.
Well, quite prophetic stuff there from the 1990s, Martin. A couple of interesting points that John Stockwell makes there was that as the Americans were preparing to leave Afghanistan, they made sure they left behind a big heroin smuggling operation.
Yes, I mean, this whole period is actually covered by a Hollywood film called Charlie Wilson's War, with Tom Cruise playing Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson being a good old boy from Texas who used to snort cocaine, have sex with prostitutes and drink lots of whiskey, and he decided that he was going to help the Afghan Mujahideen drive the evil, godless communists out of Afghanistan. And the film is basically a hero film about Tom Cruise's great job in doing all of this, by going round the rules of his own government, by talking to the Israelis to supply weaponry, Soviet era weaponry, by getting the fund. It was the most expensive undercover operation ever carried out by the CIA, and in history billions of taxpayer dollars were spent on this process. And of course, at the end of this process, what did we get? We got Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda was set up as an international brigade to fight alongside the Afghan Mujahideen, and virtually everybody, and as Robin Cook pointed out when he was Foreign Secretary, Al-Qaeda simply means the base. It was originally a database held in Amman in Jordan of all the nutcases from all over the Middle East who'd been filtered through the hands of Western intelligence and then pushed into Afghanistan. And of course, the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, that's not made clear in the film, but in actual fact it's known to be the case, the lead agency was MI6. So the British, because of their links to the area and their historical knowledge, became the lead agency on Operation Cyclone. And that is where Islamist terrorism came from. Now, you could argue, well, they lost control of these Islamist terrorists. They trained them. We know that the SAS trained them how to shoot down aircraft in Scotland. But now they've just started to go off on their own. Frankly, I don't believe that. I believe international jihadi networks are still being run by NATO intelligence services, the same NATO intelligence services that bombed Bologna in 1980 and Piazza Fontana in 1969.
In a way, it's a fascinating idea that the intelligence services would run something which is supposed to be kind of doing God's work.
Well, no, the intelligence services.
Well, I mean, that's why a lot of people join these jihadi groups, and you're saying that, that the CIA are actually somehow manipulating or training some of their mullahs, etc.
Oh, indeed. That's. But don't forget, what they're really doing is manipulating events so that certain political objectives can be met. In Italy, Gladio was all about preventing the democratic election of the Communist Party to any kind of power in Italy. In Afghanistan, it was to prevent the Soviets. I mean, in actual fact, that the help for Operation Cyclone began before the Soviet invasion, and when the Soviets invaded in 1979, a great cheer apparently went up round the State Department because they realised that the Russians had bought the bait. They'd gone into Afghanistan and they were now going to get their Vietnam, and they did. And I think the Russians should consider that very carefully when we're looking at Ukraine, because that is another potential trap for the Russian military, and they would be wise not to get engaged.
Well, John Stockwell, he was talking, they were saying he's not sure how much it cost. He knew it was that it was the most expensive at the time. But since then, a book's been published by Peter Bergen. It's called Holy War Inc., published by Free Press in 2001, where the figures are revealed of how much it cost. It began with about $20 to $30 million a year in 1980 and rose up to the incredible figure of $630 million annually by 1987, and of course it carried on a bit beyond that as well. So we're obviously talking about several billion US tax dollars spent on just literally trying to destabilise the country. Yes, and also, in that clip he says there that what they've, and this is back in the 1990s, they were saying that they're condemning Afghanistan to perpetual violence.
Yes, just as they've condemned Syria to perpetual violence and Iraq to perpetual violence and other countries in Africa and in Latin America to perpetual violence. NATO is a terrorist organisation. It's a proven to be a terrorist organisation. And we had UKIP on here earlier who want a referendum about whether we should be in the EU. I want a referendum about whether we should be in NATO. And don't forget that the French kicked out US forces from France in 1960. Why are they still here?
Well, the US SS Corps Commander Paul Hauser, who was in charge on the Eastern Front of a tank corps, that is several divisions, panzer divisions, he then became the head of what's called HIAG, H-I-A-G, which was the SS Veterans Association in Germany in the once he'd been released in the early 1950s and into the 1960s. He's on the record as saying that the first meetings of NATO were actually formed from the international supporters of the SS.
Yes, I mean, and Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo's Eastern Europe operation, becomes the head of the West German intelligence services. And the Gladio structures, these terrorist structures, were set up by NATO, by the US, by Britain, but they used a lot of people who were former fascist intelligence personnel, like Vincenzo Vincinghiero in Italy, Reinhard Gehlen in Germany. And of course, this links up to very up-to-date stuff. The far right in Ukraine, there was a telephone intercept between Catherine Ashton and Umas Piets, who was the former, foreign minister of Estonia, and Piets is speaking to Ashton on the phone, and she's saying, "Look, I've just been round the hospitals, and it looks as if the doctors are telling me that the protesters and the police have been shot by the same people, and they've all been shot in the same kind of way by snipers, and that these snipers are linked to the current regime in Kiev, not the Yanukovych regime, the previous regime." And this, of course, fits a pattern, as I was saying on Russia Today the other week. This fits a pattern of NATO provocational terrorism that goes back decades. And it also looks very similar to the sort of things that happened in Syria at the beginning of the uprising there, when mysterious snipers started shooting both police officers and protesters, and very similar things happened during the attempted coup in Venezuela some years ago, where protesters against Chavez were shot up, but they were shot up by anti-Chavez elements who were trying to provoke a bloodbath in order to make a coup.
Well, we've had just had the visit of US Vice President Joe Biden. We also had a few weeks ago the secret visit of John Brennan, the guy that investigative journalist Michael Hastings was looking at, because he was using CIA assets to actually target journalists, newspaper editors and politicians within the United States. And Michael Hastings ended up, I'm afraid, in a fiery car crash and died back in July last year in Los Angeles. But these people have been going in and out of Kiev. There's a sort of little circle going around. Then we see this week some checkpoints attacked by the Ukrainian army. I suppose the ultimate question here is, Martin, I mean, it's quite clear that by doing that sort of thing, the Kiev government do not really take seriously the idea of this being an election. If they're sending the army in to break up checkpoints, then it does sound as if they're not going to be serious about an election. But ultimately, the question is, will Putin take the bait now, as the Russians did back in Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan?
Well, that is a question. Let's just repeat what I would do if I was the Russians. And I think Sergei Lavrov was saying this the other day in the last statement I saw him make as a Russian foreign minister. Who shot the protesters at the beginning of this?
But the thing is, you know what this 24-hour rolling news is like. That's all long forgotten. It's like this Malaysian airliner. That seems to have been forgotten about.
And that's why I'm bringing us back again and again and again to this. Because if the Russians can establish that it was in fact the current government, probably working with NATO intelligence services, which killed up to 100 protesters, that ought to be enough to fracture the coalition currently governing in Kiev. And that's a much more sensible strategy than sending in the army.
Okay, Martin, thank you. Now, for our final item, we go back to the conversation I had with the campaigner from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, Granville Williams, who was talking to me a couple of weeks ago just over a week ago, about the Internet Titans in his new book called Big Media, which is out later this year.
Channel 5 at the moment is up for sale. An appalling decision, if you think back, that Richard Desmond, a pornographer, acquired the Daily Express Group and then was able to purchase Channel 5 for just over £100 million. He's selling it for £800 million. And if it will be sold to a consortium, which is Discovery and BSkyB. So we see the acquisition combination of Discovery and BSkyB of Channel 5 means a further encroachment of media ownership by already very powerful global media groups into the UK media.
What about foreign ownership? I mean, for example, with Channel 5, you're saying that's switching ownership. Which countries are these media corporations that are so powerful here in Britain based?
Well, one is German-based, Bertelsmann. That's a private company. It's still private, but it works through having a ownership of television companies, mainly in Europe. It did actually own at one stage Channel 5, but it sold it to Desmond. The big groups are essentially US-based. I mean, Murdoch's News Corporation is US-based. And then its tentacles, if you want, are global. Time Warner's a big group. But the other groups that we haven't talked about are the big new internet titans, the Googles, the Amazons. Now, these groups are very clever with their PR. They always talk about, don't do evil, or, you know, we want to be friendly, let's talk to you, let's have Facebook and share ideas. Their PR, they spend millions at a European level on lobbying to make sure that governments don't get too bothered about what they're doing. But I think we have to start worrying too about both the old traditional legacy media, these big global cross-media ownership groups, but the new groups like Google and Amazon. Amazon, for example, are having a terrifying impact in terms of distribution. Lots of small publishers, independent publishers, the margins, which are very meagre often, are squeezed by the deals that they will do. I mean, my organisation, I've just published a book called Settling Scores, We took a decision not to use Amazon because when my last book was distributed from Amazon, one of the people that was selling it for us, they actually went out of business as a result of the conditions and terms that were being put on them to distribute. And I think Amazon, we need to see it as what it is. It's a tax avoider. It seeks to, it's anti-trade union, but it also seeks often to squeeze quite ruthlessly publishing groups to boost its own dominance, its market dominance. And I think Amazon, Google, and these other big, powerful global internet groups are the new problem that media ownership needs to begin to tackle, and it will only be able to do it if it works in the way that they do it at an international level to do.
I mean, one of the new opportunities apparently is social media, with Facebook and Twitter apparently in the hands of the users away from these big corporations involved in, at least allegedly, things like the Arab Spring, almost a revolutionary media. But how much should we trust these Facebooks and the Twitters?
Well, Facebook's a very good example of which you can commercial brands can colonise it very quickly. I mean, I see that. Well, I look to, because I'm interested in the 30th anniversary of the miners' strike of 84-85 in the UK, I'm on a Facebook site, 30th anniversary of the miners' strike, and every so often you'll see a brand that somehow magically managed to get advertised on it. There is a very...
Selling coal?
Well, no, not selling coal, but selling whatever the product is, or trying to alert you to something. You say, why is that there? And what you do is a lot of the big commercial advertising groups are very actively interested in colonising what you think is a commercially free space. It isn't. The adverts cluttering around all of the Google and the rest of it. But I think people need to wake up, really, to the fact that often these what seem quite superficially attractive websites and the ability to use Facebook, it can be useful, but it also can be deceptive. You mentioned the example of the Arab Spring. I think the internet and the ability to share ideas and information played a role. I think it did. But I think the key factors in the Arab Spring were when people weren't watching their face, the screen or their computer. It's when they were out on the streets. You can do certain things by looking at a screen. Clicktivism is a lovely illusion, in my view. It's a lovely illusion that you're doing something. Actually, it's important. 38 Degrees did a lot of work around motivating people to stop the gagging bill that's just been disgracefully voted through. But in the end, people need to go to real organisation and mobilise real people in order to ensure that you get change. So I don't discredit or think that it's a waste of time to use Avaaz or 38 Degrees. I think that can motivate, it can alert people to issues, it can get them going, but in the end, you actually find in the real world you need real people and organisations that will be able to intervene and mobilise and get people on the streets or getting legislation changed through the power of organisation.
Tell us about the gagging bill and also what your thoughts are about whether we will have any really increase in diversity in media in the future.
Well, on the gagging bill, I was intrigued by why the Lib Dems were so craven in supporting it. And then you have to think about the Deputy Prime Minister, Clegg. Clegg promised, if you remember, not to introduce tuition fees. That was an election pledge. And, of course, he went back on it. Now, what is a key constituent of people? Students. If you could mobilise students, and if the NUS was to say, look, wherever there are Lib Dems standing, we have to mobilise and attack them for breaking their pledges and say we don't vote for them. So you can see out of self-interest how a politician would subscribe to a bill, which an act of Parliament now, which actually limits the rights of democratic civil society organisations and trade unions and voluntary groups to actually mobilise to do what you should do in a democratic society, express your views and vote in the way you want to get change and to oppose those people that are doing things you don't like. So that the gagging bill, I think, was a craven betrayal by Clegg about how society should be organised and how we should have voices and diversity. On the second issue, on the issue of media ownership, there is hope. Labour, well, not New Labour, but we'll see how that has changed. Labour has said that it will look to introduce legislation to limit media ownership in the UK. Now, we'll have to see how solid and realistic that those are. But
hang on, because the big players, the Murdochs and the BBCs of this world, aren't necessarily going to like that, are they, in the run-up to the next election? Are they going to be supporting a party that wants to limit their own power?
Oh, of course not. I mean, what was the lesson? I think the negative lesson that Tony Blair learnt after 92-93, when Labour were, Kinnock and Labour were defeated in the election, was that if you don't cozy up to these big media groups, you get shafted. The way in which Tony Blair flew around the world to Australia to really put himself at the mercy of Rupert Murdoch, and of course he was at the mercy. His support from the Murdoch media group was conditional, really, not on Blair being able to say, I want you to support me in my policies. It was Murdoch saying, no, it's the other way around. You support my policies. And that was the relationship. I spoke recently to a Labour MP in the north of England, and I said to him, you know, Labour was subservient under Tony Blair and Murdoch. And he said, no, it wasn't subservient. We were enslaved. And I think that was a very damaging democratic development.
It makes it sound as if actually our political parties and our MPs don't really run things, and actually some of these big media corporations really can call the shots. This is not just an illusion, that they are able to determine policy in a very undemocratic way.
Yeah. Well, I think we've seen examples of this in key legislation, and remember, there will have to be a new kind of Communications Act in the UK, whichever government is elected in 2015.
That was Granville Williams. More from him next week from the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom. Time to sign off. Now time for the Murdoch News at 7. Cyrus the Virus's typical topical Afro-tropical show, we hope, will be up next. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, UKIP Councillor for Bradley Stoke, Town Council Ben Walker, and Bristol's only independent for Bristol Councillor for King's West and Jason Budd. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week. At thisweek.org.uk you'll find us.
BCFM on 93.2 on online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. The NSPCC says it has counsellors on standby round the clock to help support those abused by teacher William Vahey. The American paedophile attacked up to 60 pupils at Southbank International School in London. The FBI says a large number of people have come forward. Don Cameron from the NSPCC's helpline says the charity has three priorities.
The first is to make sure that we provide support and assistance to the families and children, to make sure that we establish quite clearly what has been actually happening, and thirdly, to ensure that there are no other children at risk.
The Cabinet Office says offensive comments about the Hillsborough disaster posted via government computer